Lecture 14, Etruscan Government.
I traced my interest in government to binge-watching The West Wing on television with my daughter. So I suppose I should admit that this lecture is Aaron Sorkin's fault. So things are certainly going to get a bit wonky from this point on. Wonky, but educational and perhaps even entertaining. We're going to look at local and regional government in the Etruscan world, their changes over time, and how the form of Etruscan government shaped society from the aristocratic rulers of the 7th and 6th century BC to the developing participatory governments that followed them. Well, the Greek historian Strabo, who refers to the ancient Etruscans as Tyrrheni, observed that at first they were subject to the orders of only one ruler, and so they were very strong. But in later times, Strabo infers, it is reasonable to suppose their united government was dissolved, and the Tyrrheni, yielding to the violence of their neighbors, were broken up into separate cities. No modern scholar suggests that Strabo is correct, that the violence of the Etruscan neighbors caused them to shift from a central to local power structure. But that general trend from individual rule to local or regional powers makes sense, and it's supported by later evidence as the Etruscans spread throughout Italy, becoming both more numerous and dispersed. Eventually, the Etruscans' local concerns surpassed their joint objectives and experience. Or, put another way, their shared religious and cultural identity took a back seat to geographical identity. So let's start looking at local and regional rule. For the period from about 800 BC down to about 600 BC, each major Etruscan city fell under the rule of a king. This figure was a ruler for life, but not a hereditary monarch. Rather, he seems to have been selected from among the aristocratic families of the community who voted to approve him. It's probably too much to say that he was elected in the modern sense of the word, but the males in the aristocratic families had to consent to the selection however it was made. So each major city and its surrounding territory was essentially a sovereign state, ruled by a king whose authority came from the support of the wealthiest citizens. The popular imagination preserves an image of these Etruscan kings in the Aeneid, Virgil's great poem which celebrates the origins of Rome. It evokes Mezentius, the legendary king of Cerveteri, but portrays him as brutal, violent, and a denier of the gods. He was most notorious for condemning people to death by tying them to a corpse. Well, the best testimony we have on the process of selecting kings is from the Roman historian Livy, who describes the emigration to Rome in about 600 BC of Lucius Tarquinius Priscus. Livy says his name was actually Lucumo, translated as king. The name he's known by in Roman history calls him the first or the eldest of the Tarquinians, indicative of his status as an emigrant and ancestor of the final Etruscan king, Tarquinius Superbus. So either Lucumo's mother was presumptuous in his naming, or it's great foreshadowing. I suspect Livy was unaware that it was a title rather than an Etruscan name. Anyway, according to Livy, Lucumo emigrated to Rome after failing to gain office in Tarquinia despite his great wealth. With the death of the king, Ancus Martius, in Rome, Lucius, or Lucumo, addressed the popular assembly and convinced them to elect him king, since the sons of Ancus were all minors. He almost immediately added 100 new men to the Senate, thus securing his rule through their grateful support. The support of the common people seems to have been reinforced through generous beneficence in public building programs that supplied both jobs and civic improvements. you can see how the election of the new king ensured support across the entire class structure of the state, and his subsequent actions reinforced that. So far, so good. Maybe. Some scholars, myself among them, think that king is a bad translation for leukimo. We prefer tyrant. That is, tyrant in the Greek sense of a ruler whose power comes from the lower classes and who holds government at the detriment of the aristocrats, generally in violation of traditional power structures in a community, but not necessarily a despot as in the modern sense of the word. Many Greek city-states of the period were ruled by tyrants who derived their power from the acclaim of the people. Indeed, the verb form of leukimo means to rule, not to be royal. Athens provides an exactly contemporary example with the tyrant Pisistratus, who with his sons ruled Athens from 561 to 510 BC. Pisistratus also embarked on a building program and distributed the benefits of his rule across the classes, as did Lucius Tarquinius, who was elected initially by the popular assembly, the same basis of power that Pisistratus and his sons relied on. For example, Pisistratus made loans available to farmers who could borrow the money to buy and plant olives, a crop that could take a decade to provide fruit. As tyrants, each of these rulers was responsible for the government within their city and negotiations with other city-states and people. An excellent example comes from the sanctuary at Pyrgi and the mention of a treaty between Cerveteri and the Phoenicians. The founder of the sanctuary was Thephariae Velianus of Cerveteri, who was thought to be one of those tyrants who rose to power at the expense of aristocratic rule. Evidence comes from the gold Pyrgi plaques, or tablets. He is referred to on the plaques as Zilath Amke Mekel Rasnal, which means he had been a chief or ruler of the Etruscans. The Phoenician text records that he was to rule for 3 years. The longer Etruscan text states instead that he was to rule over the newly built sanctuary for 3 years, probably his term as priest, but had been chief of the Etruscans for 11 years. This 11-year period confirms that he was more than an elected official, most of whom were elected to one-year terms. He also follows the playbook of Pisistratus of Athens, who claimed that his power came from Athena herself, whom he glorified with a building program on the Athenian Acropolis. Many of these buildings and artworks contain images of Hercules, the Greek hero with whom Pisistratus associated himself, and whose patron was also Athena. Interestingly, images of Hercle, the Etruscan rendition of the Greek Hercules, are popular on pottery from Cerveteri at this period, as they are on Athenian pottery. Well, the overthrow of aristocratic rule may have been part of a pattern during the 6th century BC. In many places, hereditary aristocratic rule was replaced with tyranny, such as in Athens, Corinth, Syracuse, and, if I'm correct, Cerveteri and Rome. Now, Rome overthrew its last Etruscan king in 509 BC. That move from kingship to representative government is seen at other Etruscan cities and cemeteries. The replacement of the 6th century BC city at Marzabotto with one that featured uniform blocks and identically sized houses may reflect a 5th century shift to a more egalitarian society, as the use of orthogonal planning did at the Greek city of Miletus, where the city was redesigned to reflect their new democratic government. At Gabii, about 11 miles east of Rome, the remains of a palace from the late 6th century BC were found in 2011. The archaeologists concluded that this palace, destroyed in the early 5th century BC and replaced with an orthogonally planned city, belonged to Sextus Tarquinius, son of the last king of Rome. In the shields and chairs found in tombs from the period, men are identified not by their relationship to members of the family, as fathers, brothers, sons, etc., but by their public roles. The carved chairs and shields reflect the two outlets for male social contribution: warfare, symbolized by the shields, and government service, symbolized by the chairs conferred upon community magistrates. The increased use of these symbols in Etruscan tombs during the 5th century BC reflects the political changes of the period. Many peoples around the Mediterranean, including the Etruscans, Romans, and Athenians, were establishing democratic or republican forms of government. This rejection of kingship is seen in the Etruscan world, and the assertion of public roles for adult males is a side effect of that. Rapid social and economic shifts mirrored the political ones during the 5th century. As the kings and hereditary aristocracies lost power, they were replaced by a rising class of what we might call middle-class citizens. More aptly, these citizen soldier merchants became the new leaders and economic engines of their communities. They took positions as elected public officials and priests, replacing the old aristocracies. Essentially, the social pyramid flattened into, if not a pancake, then at least a shorter pyramid. Wealth seems to have spread more widely, probably because of trade and the vast commercial links between the Etruscans and all the peoples of the central Mediterranean. This shift in social structure is seen in the new urban planning of cities with the adoption of orthogonal planning, and the necropolis of the Etruscan world mirror it as well. Rather than a few large tombs, we see many more smaller tombs in the 5th and 4th century BC phases of the necropolis. This is the period of new political structures based on the city-state and the league. First, the city-state, referred to in Etruscan as the methlum, accurately includes both the city and the territory associated with it. We know the names of many magistrates of this period, that is, the titles of many magistrates of this period: Comthi, Maxtrev, which means magistrate, Maru, priest, Parnik, Perthne, chief local magistrate, Tamara, who was a priest with divination functions. All of these different offices were needed to replace the Leucomo and Zilath, whose powers were subdivided into civil and religious officials. The people were the mech. Now, as far as we can tell, there was a great deal of variation from city to city. Secular and religious offices were elected annually, probably as an extreme reaction against the lifetime rule of the previous rulers of these communities. Multiple annual magistracies created a collegial form of government that also helped as a check against tyranny. Nevertheless, there are problems with this form of government. For one thing, these magistrates had no incentive to undertake any action that would take longer than a year to complete. There was also no practical way to undertake a large-scale action or a long-term war. Skirmishes between Etruscan cities were generally undertaken as annual raids without long-term strategies or developed multi-year plans. This meant that territory rarely changed hands in any meaningful way, so that the city-state boundaries were largely fixed. Enemies were, therefore, never conquered, but rather attacked and then left alone to rebuild, counterattack, or develop their own alliances for the future. These factors put the Etruscans at a disadvantage when faced against people such as the Gauls or Greeks, who still relied on kings or tyrants, who could plan long-term or muster power from over a larger area. To address these, the Etruscans created confederations, which are referred to as their leagues. 12 of the leading cities from each region made up each of the three leagues. The Etruscan League of 12 city-states, which is thought to have existed between 600 and 500 BC, was in Etruria itself. Two other leagues were formed in the south, around Campania, and in the north, around the Po River Valley. Elected magistrates, priests, and many others from the 12 cities would gather annually at a sort of pan-Etruscan sanctuary called a fanu or a fanum in Latin. The Etruscan League met at the Fanum Vultumni, the sanctuary of Vultumnus, outside modern Orvieto. The Campanian League probably met at a sanctuary of Uni, outside Capua. The Northern League's regional sanctuary has not been discovered. Once assembled, they would sacrifice, read omens, and discuss political, diplomatic, and military matters, as well as elect an official who, for 1 year, would be in charge of that league. In charge of may be overstating this official's power. Even with the leagues, the Etruscans still had problems generating collective action. One classic example of the difficulties of collective action is the Etruscan response to the overthrow of Tarquinius Superbus at Rome. His home city of Tarquinia, where his extended family still resided, was the first to respond. The Tarquinians were then joined by their allied Veii, the closest Etruscan city to Rome, which probably was operating out of a sense of insecurity of how far this overthrow of Etruscan rulers might spread. Only after both were defeated in battle did Lars Porsena, the ruler of Cusae, march on Rome, attack and besiege it, but ultimately also fail. This sort of piecemeal reply is typical in a confederated organization where the majority of power resided with the individual states and the overall leader only had a year in office. Even if the elected leader wished to make a collective reply to something like the expulsion of Tarquin from Rome, he'd have to persuade all 12 of the states to act together and then get the response organized during his term. If not, the next head of the league would have to pick up where his predecessor left off and convince another set of magistrates from 12 cities to all agree again. I'm sure you can see the problem. It's a system designed primarily to limit power and to keep it in the hands of local city-states. And at that, it works very well. A good parallel is found in the Articles of Confederation, ratified by the 13 American colonies after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The Articles gave the Continental Congress no power to tax, nor any power to regulate trade or commerce between themselves, the states themselves, or with foreign powers. Congress did have the ability to conduct diplomacy with foreign governments, which apparently the Etruscan League did not, unless we can make the leap, as some have, that the Fariae Velianus of Trivedere was head of the League during the year he dedicated the sanctuary at Pyrgi. Me, I like the idea, but I'd prefer a bit of evidence. The Articles of Confederation were quickly seen as an inadequate form of governing and replaced by the U.S. Constitution. Like the Articles, the Etruscan League similarly lacked taxation powers and the ability to regulate commerce, to conduct diplomacy, or to wage war, as there was no league army. It existed as an agency to allow the various Etruscan states, or at least the 12 major ones, to work out problems between themselves. But without an enforcement mechanism, it could rely only on persuasion, and only if the cities agreed unanimously. All carrot, no stick. The Etruscans were united by a common culture, including language, religion, and social structures, but unfortunately not against their common enemies, except in the most dire circumstances, and even then, only in very limited ways. In 414 BC, the Etruscans sent 3 pentaconters, this is the 50-oared ship of the line, to aid the Athenian invasion of Sicily and their siege of Syracuse. This small fleet was under the command of Velther Spurinna from Tarquinia. If successful, the Athenian invasion would have eliminated the greatest Greek city in the West, and the leader of the Greek communities that was responsible for the disastrous Etruscan loss at the Battle of Cumae in 474 BC. Yet, even with this motivation, they couldn't rouse themselves to send more than 3 ships. Of course, the Athenians eventually lost, and Syracuse continued as the most powerful Greek city in the West until the Romans destroyed it in 212 BC. For an example with longer-term consequences for all of the Etruscans, the Roman siege of Veii went on for almost exactly 10 years, from 405 to 396 BC, during which time the people of Veii were only able to scrape up 2 allies amongst the communities in southern Etruria. And those only because they feared that if Veii fell, they'd be next in line for Roman attack. So nowhere near the full 12 they needed for league action. And only 2 of the 150 Etruscan city-states that we know of. 2 allies to withstand an attack from Rome. Now, it's very likely that Rome was viewed as much as an Etruscan community as the others around it. After all, its final 3 kings had been Etruscan. And within the first century of the Republic, as many as 50% of the elected magistrates were Etruscan. Quite possibly, the League viewed the war as a local conflict between 2 Etruscan cities and decided deliberately not to involve themselves. In support of this idea, only 10 years after Rome's defeat of Veii, a proposal was made in the Senate to move from Rome to Veii. It was rejected, but it seems to have been seriously considered. In such a desperate situation as Veii, the Romans would have elected a dictator, a constitutional office that placed emergency civic and military power in the hands of 1 man. They did this repeatedly in their history until the time of Julius Caesar. Veii reacted similarly according to its constitutional tradition, as the historian Livy tells us. He says in Book 5, "The people of Veii, on the other hand, tired of the annual canvassing for office, elected a king. This gave great offense to the Etruscan cantons, owing to their hatred of monarchy and their personal aversion to the one who was elected. He was already obnoxious to the nation through his pride of wealth and overbearing temper. They decided, in consequence, that no assistance should be given to the Veientines as long as they were under a king." This is a great example of how the limitations of their government contributed to the eventual defeat of the Etruscans. The Etruscans didn't have the benefit of Benjamin Franklin to tell them, "We must all hang together, or assuredly, we shall all hang separately." Well, because of their league system and rejection of the steps taken by Veii to try to save itself, the Etruscans refused to act to stop Rome at that point. As a consequence, Rome went on to defeat Etruscan cities, one after another, through the next century. The failure of the League to act against Rome, Syracuse, and other threats, and the absence of constitutional forms which allowed individual city-states the chance to respond to threats with the temporary rule of a single, powerful individual, made them all vulnerable. The result is seen throughout the 4th century BC, as individual Etruscan city-states made separate treaties with Rome. In addition to the lack of cooperative action, the Etruscans were also doomed as much by their lack of a grand strategy. replying piecemeal to enemies was a great failure. But perhaps an even larger one was the inability to decide who their enemies truly were. The reliance on local, annually elected magistrates and a spotty league system led to inconsistent application of diplomacy and power. Perhaps the starkest example was in the late 4th century BC. In 311 BC, the Etruscans sent 1,200 troops to fight in Sicily for the Carthaginian general Hamilcar against Agathocles of Syracuse. That makes some historical sense. The Syracusans were responsible for Etruscan losses in 474 and 414 BC, and this might be seen as an attempt to weaken this great power. All well and good. Except that only 4 years later, in 307 BC, 18 Etruscan ships were sent to help Agathocles against the Carthaginians. These could have been separate actions by individual city-states, whose positions encouraged the support of different sides in the struggle, but the fact that it occurred demonstrates the weakness of Etruscan central government and planning. It's as if some of the North American colonies of the British sent troops to support the French during the French and Indian Wars. They would have been seen as treasonous and definitely acting against their own self-interest. Fortunately, well, for the future of British North America, the colonies had governors with oversight, allowing them to create strategy and multi-year terms of office, allowing them to implement it. The Etruscan system of governments shows the problems avoided by the more flexible Roman forms. Nevertheless, all of the ancient authors who comment on it agree that Roman offices are based on the Etruscan ones, and that many of the trappings of Roman government, such as the curule chair, fasces, toga, and so forth, were initially Etruscan. The Greek historian Strabo says that the triumphal and consular adornment and, in a word, that of all of the rulers, was transferred to Rome from Tarquinia, as also fasces, axes, trumpets, sacrificial rites, divination, and all music publicly used by the Romans. We also have one of the very latest Etruscan portraits from the 1st century BC. It's a large bronze of a man inscribed with the name Aulus Metellus. He stands, one hand extended in a gesture of speaking, wearing a toga, senatorial boots, and a ring indicating middle-class rank. These are all Etruscan signs of civic service and status adopted by the Romans. This is far more than a superficial list of things the Romans borrowed from the Etruscans, or that the Greeks wanted to believe that they had. It indicates that the outward signs of rule were all Etruscan. And I think we can go further and argue that the signs work only because they are recognized symbols of the same thing in each culture. For example, the fasces represent the ultimate authority in the state, the people, and their vesting of that authority in the person of the ruler. Similarly, the statue of Jupiter in the Capitoline Temple was dressed like an Etruscan in the toga picta. This was associated with serving magistrates and successful generals, and its purple color was long associated with royalty because of the expense of the dye to make it. That might sound silly, but the purple dye came from a variety of sea snail, the murex, that was harvested and processed by the Phoenicians along the coast of modern Lebanon, hence its ancient name, Tyrian purple, from their city of Tyre, about 50 miles south of Beirut. The dye was literally worth its weight in silver, and so its use was restricted to the very wealthy and thus upper class. The import relied on Phoenician traders who brought it with them to trade with the Etruscans. The Etruscans also originated the regular white toga of citizenship, as well as the toga praetexta, a white toga with a purple stripe that, when worn by an adult man, was a sign of a serving magistrate. As with the Etruscans, Roman men assumed, through these symbols, an identity that was originally based on their city, and then, as it expanded, on their civic rank. So the Etruscan symbols and forms of government directly informed Roman forms and symbols. Certainly, the symbols of government were one legacy of the Etruscans and their experiences with governance, but not the only one. There's also a key lesson to be found in their adoption of elected government, and the reflection of that is seen in their cities, houses, and tombs, and in their failure to generate a workable central government that could secure the liberty of the Etruscan states against outside aggression.